This is Tell Me Something Good About Retail with Bob Phibbs, the Retail Doctor.
I think the real things we're running into with stores, frankly, is stores were designed to run on, let's say, 8 people on the floor are now being run by 1 person, and people are railing online and, you know, oh, everything's being stolen. And it's like, well, it's not a mystery, kids.
Welcome to Tell Me Something Good About Retail with your host, Bob Phibbs, the champion for a more human connection in retail for over 30 years as a retail doctor. Bob is the authority on brick-and-mortar retail across the world, who works with some of the biggest luxury brands to independent retailers of all sizes.
Hey, it's Bob Phibbs, the Retail Doc. Thanks for joining me today for this edition of Tell Me Something Good About Retail. Today, I'm speaking with Robert Grimet, SVP and Executive Creative Director at Imagine Studio. Welcome, Robert.
Thank you. Thank you, Bob. It's so good to be here.
I appreciate that. And notice he is a Robert and I'm a Robert, but I go by Bob. So there we have it. If you're confused in the car, the more formal one is the guest. All right. So your namesake brand, Robert Mason, made you go through PTSD. So I want to hear that story, my friend.
Yeah. So it's a long one. So prepare yourself, fasten your seatbelts. I love talking retail, so I'll be a talker here. But I had a really early start. I'm one of those lucky folks that knew what I wanted to do very early on. And so when you're younger, you have zero fear. And starting a business at 12 years old was how I did that. And so I've always been really fascinated by merchandising, how to compel a customer to shop. And so I did that out of my parents' basement. Really, at the first, it was graphic design. This was before people had computers in their homes. So it was a business that I identified as something that I could do. But I have office supplies because I'm an office supply fanatic off to the side. And I noticed that when people would come into my parents' basement, which they didn't like very much, to do graphic design work or to give me work, they would say, can I buy that? Or, you know, do you have extra? And I started to see that as a possible revenue stream. So push comes to shove. Let's fast forward like 6 months. The city actually found out I was selling stuff out of my parents' basement.
Just for 1 sec. We're in Columbus, Ohio.
Ravenswood, West Virginia. I'm originally from Ravenswood, West Virginia.
All right. Now continue. The city finds out.
It was a city street. Obviously, it's not zoned for commercial. It was a small town. They were doing it really as a teaching lesson, an encouragement to me. So they had me go to city council and present what would be my business plan, what was I doing, what was I up to. And they actually issued a real business permit and rezoned the street for me. So I was official, and I still keep that framed very near and dear. But also when you're young, that just lights the fire under you to go further and to push, because now I have a license. Like, there's nothing to stop me at that point. So by 16 years old, I had a storefront in the local shopping center. My parents came to work for me when I was 17 and 18 years old. And I still wanted to do other things. I was still in a small town in West Virginia. So I looked at, you know, art schools and which one would I want to go to. And then here I have a business. What do I do with that? So my parents ended up purchasing it. It was under the namesake, like you had mentioned, Robert Mason. And so I chose to go to the Art Institute. What's fascinating about in my journey of where I am today and what I do today, yes, I started a business and I have that entrepreneurial lens. But there was a little period of time before I had to move to Chicago for school. And I thought, you know, I need to go to a bigger city. I can't just go from 4,000 people to millions. So I went to Charleston, West Virginia, which is still not remarkably large, 44,000 people. And I went to the local mall. This is 1998, 1999. So malls were bustling, busy. And I applied at every single store and I didn't have a preference. I really wanted to work at, you know, in apparel or something like that. But I didn't have a preference. It was basically who was going to call me back first that I'd go work for. And it was the one I didn't think would. It was the one I didn't think I would be a good fit for. But it was Bath & Body Works. So I'm 19 years old working at a Bath & Body Works in Charleston Town Center. And it was just this immersion training for me to see retail in a different light. It was sensory overload. It was brand and 3D. And the mall stores, not all of them had gotten to that point yet. They were at some sort of decor level, but not like three-dimensional brand. And I had in my business that was still operating in Ravenswood, kind of mimicked what retail was then. It had gondola. It had the red and white ceilings with fluorescent lights, you know, some track light. It had a very retail feel, but this was, you lived that brand. And this was back when it looked like the, you know, Midwest, the market stores, Excelsior and Barrels and the scents. So I thought, how do I go back to Robert Mason and do that? What do I have to do? What did Bath & Body Works do? And I put that into the office supply world, reinvent the category, which was the business that I clearly had developed in Ravenswood. And so I double majored in school in visual communication and architecture, knowing that I'm going to need to have the brand plus the structural component together to go 3D. Either if I go visual communication, it's 2D and stays flat, or if I go completely architecture, it's not going to then have the aura and the ethos and the DNA that I wanted to involve. So I really then landed on my passion place, all the way up to where I am today. So in that journey, I worked for and had the benefit of working for Fortune 50 brands, very globally recognized brands, and learned a lot of what to do, a lot of what not to do. I won't mention any of those brand names, but you know, it's a learning experience. It's the Street Smarts portion to add to my portfolio of what I knew. And I knew at one point I was still going to go back into that business because it was still operating. So at a point in 2012, so still many years later, I won't reveal which years were my college years because then it'll date me, but the jumping off the cliff moment happened again. It's an entrepreneurial thing. You know, you have that passion. You've been building a plan in the back of your mind, and I've worked for all these companies to pull this knowledge in. How do I then now again reinvent a category, put a brand out there in the office supply space to apply what I had learned? And what I found was it was so many years later that category had been commoditized even further down. And we were at the point of you would go to a store and a binder would be in red, blue, or black. We lost all the rest of the colors. There was no option for any upgraded materials. The pins were Bic stick, you know, on a pegboard. So I had to very quickly think, well, if I'm going to upgrade into a Bath & Body Works level of an in-store experience, sensory experience, I can't do that. So I went into product development at the same time. And that was fascinating because you do apply a lot of the technique and a lot of the trend that you would do in a store environment to the level of a multi-sensory experience into product development too. And so that was almost street smart training of what is a story and storytelling in retail theater. And that just really connected all the dots. Then the product was intentional. The store environment was intentional. The brand came to life and had a story. And that's where I had a lot of my clients really resonate, because some of the brands that we carried, you could have purchased in other places, but they chose us for the story and the atmosphere and experience. And I think that's really what retail is about when we're looking at how to compel consumer behavior, is what is a differentiator? What is disruptive to create that differentiation? And what is compelling them to buy from you? Because there's all of the main things that we have to have, like quality and value. And we obviously have those very specific niche products that might be different from category to category. A prime example, back to Bath & Body Works, before they did that, soap purchasing was very different. It was a bar of soap and potentially a drugstore. And they just really came in with this groundbreaking idea. And then the environment was the next disruptive piece. So when I work in what I do today, that's not left. And all of that has applied to everything that I do and I'm super passionate about, because my slogan basically from all of that has been, if it's done and it's out there, it's been done. And if we want to compel differentiation, then we have to innovate and we have to look for what's next.
Nice.
That's my life. That's my story.
Not quite. You left out the part about the PTSD.
Would you be referring to the fire?
I think that's what I'm talking about. Yeah, that was your quote, my friend.
See, PTSD. So I was in my therapy, I have avoided that top. No, I'm kidding. Yeah, so in this groundbreaking, revolutionary new store and brand that I opened that was winning awards, and I was in magazines, and we had been recognized by the National Geographic magazine for travel and the Washington Post. Like, we were just hitting it. It was going so well. And it was in a pop-up location at that point. So that, to me, was still disruptive. Open, take, you know, some of the co-joined synergy that I have with the store that I was inside of, which just so happened to be a very niche bakery. Ate way too many brownies during that period of time, I must mention. But unfortunately, 6 to 7 months later, with all of that great success and all of that investment that I had built into a pop-up that became a pop-up on steroids, it burned down in one night. And it was electrical in nature, so it was out of everybody's control. But you learn a lot of life lessons that way too. And I can really look at life that way on a lot of cards that have been laid out that are hard in the moment, but you really do learn or take something from them, including, like I mentioned, working for retailers. So you very quickly see that cash flow positive goes cash flow negative day by day, because there's no revenue coming in. You know, it's going to be a very long process. It was picked up by a lot of press of, you know, a lot of businesses don't come back. But you know what? We did. And what's fascinating about that was that I got a call from a big major retail fashion apparel brand that knew our stuff from being in publications and said, if you rekindle some of that, rebuild some of that product, we'll sell it at our web and e-commerce brand. And they did, which then got recognition from investment partners that were interested in coming back into the business, and we came back.
Nice. I
love that. So rising from the ashes was literal. That. Yeah.
Well, you know, we talk about stores. In case you didn't realize, that's what we're going to be talking about today, is actual physical brick and mortar stores, which is basically what I only want to talk about.
I love talking about them.
Who do you think does a great job right now? Well, let me preface that. There's never been more money spent on stores than what we are seeing right now. Everything from the sleek and the minimal all the way to the rock climbing wall, basketball court, VR, AR, whatever it's going to be. But in the end, just because you spend a lot of money on it doesn't mean it's a compelling atmosphere. So who do you think?
Well, so when I had referenced a few minutes ago that there is the always looking for what's next, that's where retail is today. We don't know what the store of tomorrow is. We are still trying to figure that out. And I think that's extremely exciting, but that is causing a lot of investment as we look at the store size, the box size, the journey. You know, from a commodity perspective, do we have to dedicate that much space? Do people have time to walk mega stores? Do we? A lot of those questions, right? And so there's a lot of knee jerks until we throw the spaghetti at the wall to see what sticks. But I think that's the fun part, because we are reinventing, and all of those things like gamification and AR, VR are coming into play. And we're just now testing to see what that means. And so when someone cracks that code, we're going to have what the future is. But technology is changing so fast, I think that that's going to continue to evolve.
So give me names. Names.
So I love Nike. Nike, I think, because the word innovation comes into play. I when you start to invest in showing then telling the story of a brand and a product and why you developed it and the technology around it, if you're part of that education process in a very beautiful and innovative, since that's the word that I would apply to their merchandise too, they do it well. They do it great. I think that there's also, when you cross categories into QSR, we all know that Starbucks kills it with the connecting mobile technology. Certainly. Yeah. Third place, mobile pickup in areas where that's necessary, licensed stores within other stores, their brand is on it, but they also have values. And so when I start to look at these brands that you had mentioned, you know, we can also say Costco, you know, it's a different format, is doing really, really well, not doing the whole experiential thing, but they know what their customer wants. But if you start to hit that quality and value piece that I had said before, the innovation, the values alignment with what their brand DNA is, which we would say Starbucks would align with that. There's criteria that causes that human connection to a brand, and that will be why they shop in that type of environment. So, but when it be Patagonia, here's a great example, social change or social justice, all those things wrapped up into a brand story, you then have that audience that you connect with there. And that's when us as designers then come in and have to reflect that story, like at Bath & Body Works, of how do we tell someone that may never have seen this before, that this is what we're all about, this is what we do, and this is why we have the merchandise that we have, without them having to read it on a, you know, a plaque.
Well, Bath and Body Works, I think this is visceral. I think that
right.
You walk up and who has a windmill with those bright colors and everything all set up and the angles are all set up and you're like, you are amazing. But I think, you know, to your point, know what the customer wants. I don't think anybody knows what the customer wants. And I think we're being sold a bill of goods that we all want to strap computers in our face and be in a store and not be in a store. Sorry. And to your point, try to get you going here a little bit.
No. I mean, I can respond to that.
But I don't know how many people that give a crap about their story. I mean, Nike has amazing stores in New York City, each one different, amazingly targeted store design. I mean, I totally get that. But I think this idea that everything is out with the bathwater, that since COVID and et cetera, I think the real things we're running into with stores, frankly, is stores were designed to run on, let's say, 8 people on the floor are now being run by 1 person. And people are railing online and, you know, oh, everything's being stolen. And it's like, well, it's not a mystery, kids. I mean, yeah. Geez, you cut. So realistically, that has to change sight lines and things that you're doing. Plus, we won't talk about locking everything up under lock and key. But, you know, I'm reminded of a conference I attended, and it was on all of these marketing directors, and it showed all of the ads that they wanted to create. These were amazing ads. You would sit there and you'd be like, that, I want that. And they go, and now look at what we have to do. 2 for 1, 30% off this weekend only. And I would have to think that'd be the same in store design, isn't it?
Well, like, that's a slippery slope. Yeah, once you attach a brand to promo, it's a slippery slope because you create an expectation and then people wait for those deals. So that's a very fine line on how you approach that. You lose brand integrity in that way. And then if you have a very exclusive merchandise line, you can play that card. If you have a national brand, then you are competing, right? And that is a margin race and who's going to be the best price and things like that for sure. But I think that instead of not wanting to adapt to the fact that we do have those computers in our vases all the time, retail has to adapt to the fact that that's not going away and we have to embrace it and bring that into what is part of the store environment. It is part of the thing that we haven't figured out. How, when that device walks into that door, does it help you? Because we can't just throw a digital display on the wall now and say that we did something digital. That's not digital at all.
People do that.
Yeah, that's what they do, right? 100%. So if you start to walk through and there is something that we have inherently learned behavior that was not taught to us to use those devices, so now how does that device help them inside your physical store? And we do still crave experience. We sometimes, and I've heard this with the young generations, they're so in their phone, they've grew up so in their phone that now they actually want experience. So we're going full circle. But you have to celebrate those experiences. They have to be meaningful and product that's not toilet paper or paper towels. Like, that's not stuff we want to have an experience around. Those are commodities. Those we can do drive up. We can have it ordered online, all that stuff. That means the boxes can be smaller. So what I'm starting to see, it's almost like my analogy is, if we all remember service merchandise and Best, the showroom was small, the warehouse was big, it was a paper catalog, that's how people shopped that way. We just have an electronic version now. And that's not meaning that we are not, there's still a digital component to this from the shopper experience, but the box may be more warehouse now. We are asking people to bring stuff out to our cars. We are having stuff delivered. And if it's local delivery, it can compete with the fact that you might have to go into the store. When you do go into that store, what's left of it, or if the showroom's smaller, there's still got to be a way to either locate merchandise or entice someone to shop. A great opportunity for a lot of the big brands is their owned brand or their private label brand. They have every ability in the world to make that interactive in some way that may not be the national brand that's giving them some sort of marketing dollars, but you need to have, if it is AR, VR, or gamification, or how do we integrate generative AI into this equation of efficiencies? Because that can be efficient for the store level and for the customer. But you brought up a really good point that I don't want to miss out on talking about, and that is service. Service is never going to be a thing that we're humans. Human connection is a part of the things I look at too. We still crave customer service. We do go somewhere, we identify when we've seen it, and we definitely identify when we don't get it. Theft is attached to floor coverage. We all know it. the CEO of Lowe's had given a really good keynote, or had talked to his team during a shareholder conference about their theft. They're not even seeing it escalate, and it's not above what they expect for shrink because they've staffed their stores. And you have mentioned, you know, you throw the baby out with the bath. It's 100%. You've made the decision to cut staff so that you can perhaps meet your EBITDA, but then you've now, your shrink just went up, you know, a million times, and then your visual merchandising has to change to protect that merchandise.
Well, and that's the whole point though, right? Because we're talking about, and we'll take a break here in just a minute, we're talking about how do you come up with a store that sells more. I think the future is going to be in the boutiques, that's for sure. They seem to have figured out there's certainly, you know, Anthropology and Free People, and there's a lot of really interesting little people that are playing in this space. But quite simply, I think the gimmickry of retail is getting old. You know, again, oh, here's a basketball court. Is anyone ever in there?
Yeah.
No, we have a basketball court.
Yep.
Yeah, you. Or Schofields, the most interesting store in the world. That was like a garage sale. I walked in, it's three stories, and had a slide that didn't work. So it was a real estate ploy. Let's not call these things innovative.
Right.
At the end of the day, if I'm going to leave my cocoon and get in my car and go through New York traffic or LA or whatever, and take a risk that when I walk in the door, someone's going to give a crap, and you have someone who's not trained, who doesn't care, ultimately, you just gave up the whole reason I went, which is discovery.
Yeah.
I want to find something. I want to feel I matter, but I can get most anything you carry online already. So we'll get your answer to that after this quick break from SalesRx. Hey, it's Bob again. I'm not only your host, but also the founder of the SalesRx online retail sales training program. How many sales that should have been yours walked out your front doors today? You know, with shoppers being more discerning about where and when they shop, you need to convert more lookers to buyers. And SalesRx is the perfect solution to make training memorable. It's bite-sized, it can fit easily into your schedules. Don't tell me you don't have time to train. If you can give them time to take a break, you have time for them to train. Now, the training builds from some of the quickest ways to engage shoppers to the most advanced. Everything is planned so you can implement your sales training program with a click of a button. And there's a reason we're on four continents training thousands, because SalesRx is scalable. Everybody learns the same new skills that will grow your sales. In fact, 83% of users report a double-digit increase in their sales within 6 months. Wouldn't you like that to be your story? Visit SalesRx to learn more and set up a call with me to see how we can help. That's SalesRx.com. Now back to the broadcast. All right, and before we continue, just remember, we love our loyal listeners, so do me a favor and give us a 5-star rating on your podcast right after this episode, and certainly let us know. We'll return to speaking with Robert Grimet, SVP and Executive Creative Director at Imagine Studio. So we were talking about discovery and how important that is in retail. Has that changed?
No, it hasn't at all. And it goes back to also knowing your customer, right? So if you truly do connect, and the human connection part might be, you know, the closest to your brand, there isn't a one-size-fits-all answer to what is retail and what is the box. When we built stores and when we built the brand, there was something different that we obviously had started to build that got them into the stores before. The world has changed, and now we have to adapt. Or if we don't, you go away, right? That's just how it is. So the human connection, brands, we can look at luxury retail. There is a huge set service level. There is a sensory experience attached to that too. I wouldn't go spend the dollars on that high margin product without having some sort of really, really great experience. So we can take notes from that. There's ways to do that and not have it at the extreme luxury level. There are ways to create design intent around store design and not spend an extreme amount of money. But I think one of the biggest things for me is when people, it's like what we talked about when we started. If it's been done, it's done, right? So move on to the next thing. And I think that's what I see too much of, is there are brands that I could call out right now, and I can't because some of them are clients, but they are.
Whisper to me. No one will hear.
I'm going to use my fingers and spell them out. Okay, let me give you an example. This happened, you know, many years ago when I was working for a brand that had the same problem. when I would do customer intercepts in the parking lot, because I really enjoy hearing what a customer says live in action, I just put them right on the spot because they're going to be brutally honest. That's the way to get strategy. When they walked out of the store, I'd say, don't look behind you and tell me what store you just walked out of. And I would say 50% of the time, they would say the wrong name. That was because they were like a competitor that was exactly the same model, that had the same colors, that looked like the same stuff, and they didn't differentiate themselves. So that customer went there not out of brand loyalty and not out of any type of, it was a necessity. It was a to-do list, check off the box. That wasn't fun for them. So that kind of stuff is going to, one of them are going to probably go away. There's not a differentiator enough to make them different. So
no, I agree with you.
And differentiator can be tech, and differentiator can be like could be. Customer service. You know,
yeah, I think it's still going to be people. If I don't,
no,
think
I agree.
People,
I agree.
You know, I've seen so many iterations of, we'll put iPads everywhere. Great. No. And then most of the time can't connect to server, doesn't do it. But I think the thing we're losing really in retail is a profession of visual merchandisers.
100%.
We have task orderers. Put that crap over here, like we told you, the planogram, and don't pivot from it. Yep. And you're like, okay, so now you're making your employees brain dead. They're filling online orders. And suddenly this damn customer's in our way. Could you move? I've got to get this, right? And we've so turned everything on its head that the chance for that employee, that associate, that frontline person to actually shine, even though we're paying them 20, 25 bucks an hour, hoping, dear God, you'll stay, they don't have a chance to be anything but a robot. So how, if you're speaking to a CEO, and you have the magic recipe, right? Because you have your in-store marketing and retail design trend study, and you said that, you know, texture and pattern, organic shape, larger than life, color and light, fabric, flexible and structural. You have these design trends, right? They're out there. Where are you looking to I think it's easy to say technology, right?
Yep.
Where would they start to look at it? And if you want a bonus point, you want to add sustainability in there, that's great too.
Yeah. So, I mean, I think that goes back to the brand ethos and DNA. I mean, I will see some clients that do say that you have to walk that walk if you talk that talk. And if you don't, and you say you are, that is a very bad idea. That's greenwashing. And that's a terrible thing because I'm very passionate about sustainability. So I get my bonus point first. But no, I think that you're absolutely right on that experience. If how are we, and even the trend studies that I put out say, it's the silent salesperson approach that we all went to, right? Over time, we said that we can't depend on that in-store associate, and shame on us for saying that, because that's a training problem. We couldn't depend on that sales associate, so we had to put stuff in the store to sell it for them or to replace them because the customer needed something. I do also blame technology for that. So I do believe that because sales is a process and there is training involved on how to sell something, and someone wants to sell something in their store, people will use their device to get actual, what they consider real advice or real reviews or real information when they don't trust somebody that might be selling them on the floor. I mean,
nobody sells. No. No one sells on the floor, dude. That is such a canard. That means myth. That is just, that
what's
is
that?
You're so wrong. It's like, no one, have you ever been in a retail store when someone tried to sell you? No one.
Point taken. And you know, we've gone further with like, just walk out technology. I know.
I don't want to be salesy. It's like, why not? I'm in there to buy my shirt. Get me three of them. You have me half naked in a fitting room. I am yours. Do with me what you want. I should have 5 pair of jeans and socks to go with the new shoes. Well, that'd be pushy. I couldn't do that. Then what the hell are you doing there? That's the fun of retail.
Sorry, I know. No. I think that's a big systemic problem of large brands and publicly traded companies, is that they have to appease something that may not be their primary and core business that we're all working on, which is that shopping. They need to make shareholder value, and that means cutting costs, and that ultimately means cutting humans. And retail, if you think all the way back to the glory days of Marshall Fields and such, it was service. I mean, that's what we loved.
Marshall Fields.
Yeah, I still won't call it there. I know. Well, really? Go there. I was in college. The people, I was one of them that stood out in front of Marshall Fields contesting that it would ever change its name.
Wow.
Yeah. Yep. I'm one of those because I went to school in Chicago.
I was in LA, so ours was Bullocks. Bullocks yep. was the
all the nameplates.
You can still go into Pasadena Lake Street store, which is now Macy's, and you can see what it used to be. And you're like, you know, it's if sad. You just devoted yourself, mm-hmm. it would be amazing. And I think it's mm-hmm. the same thing with Marshall Fields. It's like clear out all the clearance junk and bring it in. But now they're going to sell the roof. You know, they're now the top floors are thing. So it's to get so back to a positive thing, what would you say to a brand? I would even say like a Macy's, because I think with Macy's, I would start with people. You have to have more people better trained. However, where would they look to the future? Because I don't think retail is a hard thing to do. It's just a matter of being brilliant on the basics, right?
Yeah, well, so when you do identify those customers and you don't have to say that you're the best for everyone, right? Like we all would love to be that. So if you say, okay, I've got the generation that did the tech, let's be really good at that. And then the in-store for the younger generations and those of us that really miss experience, then embrace that too. Do those two really good. But if they need to see an example of this in action, I actually was just in Mexico the last 2 weeks prior to this one. And you start to see what it used to be like. And it's really nostalgic. There was intense customer service. People really cared and smiled. To your point earlier, when we start to see someone that may not be providing great service, they have 20 tasks on them that was not the original task that they were hired for. The register's running on them. They're stocking the shelves. Oh, by the way, we have to get a drive-up order. We have to also pack this to go. Like that, you don't see that in other countries right now, not all of them. And that's nostalgic retail. And there's two brands in Mexico that I absolutely adore besides the independents, because independents will always win when it comes to service. And it is Liverpool and El Palacio. It is the old department stores. And what we think is, we say it all the time, department stores are dead, department stores are dead, department stores are dead. They are not dead.
I don't say that, but all right.
I mean, but we hear it all the time.
You don't say
it's
that
It's a
either.
Real estate game.
Right, exactly.
I think it's department stores has to reinvent itself. When you do stay stagnant, that you will be phased out. You will be replaced because that was, again, a generational thing. You
well,
know,
even
the malls
then,
are going through it too.
If you go back, I hope Macy's is one of your clients. You are based in Ohio, but and you go back and you look at how Federated bought Macy's and then changed the name. So it was not we're not dealing Campo. We're not dealing with the same group. But then they bought up all their competitors and beige them all. And so you know, if I was had their ear, I would say break them back apart, bring back Marshall Fields, and you know, cleave them off and say, we want these to all be different. You are the, you know, to your point, I love that idea, Robert. You are going to be our tech gen folks. So you're going to be in downtown LA. You're going to be over there in Brooklyn. And you're going to be, you know, they really strategically go and get some energy around these new designs and say, wow, that's really amazing. But I think what we end up with is press releases, how we're going to be different. And then you get your 30% off this weekend only, you know, with hashtags. And
I think you nailed it. I actually think you nailed it. I think you should sell that idea. I think that when we like, think about what makes, so we've said.
You and me together, buddy. You have
I know,
to
we're going to kill it.
I think the people.
The Roberts, right? So I think that if you really think about it from a, when you look at when we buy something, there is there's the things we talked about today, but there is an emotional purchase, right? And if you go back to nostalgia, it works when a lot of these, and I don't see it a ton, but I wish I did. My brand was, it was as nostalgic back to the days when office supplies were embraced and we loved fountain pens and things like that. People really, really resonate with that. So if you brought back those old nameplates and started to brand in that manner, I think that could be a really good play. I mean, that was brilliant. Well done.
Well, thank you.
I think you solved it.
I just thought of that. I've solved it. Next, world hunger.
Here's the bell.
Yeah, here's your bell. That's right.
I mean, I would go, wouldn't you? Wouldn't you go back to one of them that you used to shop at to go see that?
Like, because I didn't live in that world. You know, I that was a world like it started in retail as Bullocks was being dismantled, Buffum's, Robinson's, May, those guys, they all had their own, for the Broadway in Los Angeles, they all had their regional things, but I never would have seen myself as a guy going to Bullocks. And then when you see what a Bullocks Wilshire was like,
you really know how far we've come.
Terry Lundgren started was there, and you look at the way we did get it right then. Yeah. See, that's where I keep going back to. Like, you don't have to be, the future is, we're all going to be this. It's like that sense of wonder. This is where I go back to, my friend.
The magic, yes.
It was a place to probably slow up. But, you know, when that middle part of our brain where I'm buying based on price and I'm trying to decide, is this a good value? When you leave me there, that's where you're in trouble, because I could click and buy something. But when you get me in wonder, like, what would I look like if I had that on? And you're there and say, go try it on. And I'm like, no, I couldn't try it on. Try it on. Okay. But we've lost that.
Yeah. Because there's
you
no
need
magic.
That person to give you that, that permission to go be this other person you want to be. And your store designs do the same things for us. It suddenly takes us into that, I wonder what, which you captured as a 12-year-old creep. But I was I was running around a ball field or something. I don't know. But I love our conversation here. I love the idea of the Roberts taking on retail. I would love
Let's do that.
We should do that, my friend.
I think passion shines through. Let's do it.
I agree with you. Well, this gives us a great place to end. I always end all my podcasts asking our guests, so tell me something good about retail, Robert.
I will always go back to there's magic in retail. It's theater. I think that's enjoyable. I think it's fantastic. It is nostalgic. It is when we want to go back to experience things that we all grew up with it. This is something, it's one of the oldest, you know, trades. It's exciting. And I do miss the human connection. So I do go back to find those brands that still have it.
I love that. And that feeling of coming home to retail, wouldn't that be a nice thing to do for your marketing and do it in a new way? To your point, you're not going to do it like, oh, and this is what it was like in the 50s, because it'll smell like that and look like that. No. This is, look at all the things they got right. See, that's where I think you come in, my friend. Yep. And it's been a delight to have you, probably twice as long as you're expecting to be, my friend.
I would do this all day long.
We could do this all day long. So thanks for joining us on Tell Me Something Good About Retail. And you can find out more about Robert in the show notes below. Thanks for listening today.
You've been listening to Tell Me Something Good About Retail with Bob Phibbs, the retail doctor. As a listener, you can receive free information and guides when you visit retaildoc.com and sign up for our exclusive weekly newsletter. Thanks for being with us. Remember to subscribe on iTunes, Spotify, or wherever you like to get your podcasts. To virtually bring Bob to all of your crew and associates, check out www.salesrx.com.